You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome to Connect Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today on this fine Tuesday, as we are here every day, Monday through Friday, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And today, I have a special guest. That was his voice right there, breaking in from a whole nother country and everything. His name is Sam Rocha. Or Rocha, depending on how you pronounce things. I'm just going to go ahead with Rocha. He's an assistant professor at the University of British Columbia, pastoral philosopher in residence at St. Mark's College, a very fine name for a college, by the way. Yeah. And he's kind of my boss in a sort of a way that him actually being my boss. But he's the editor of the Patheos Catholic channel, or perhaps it's Patheos. No one really knows how to pronounce it. And his new book of essays, Tell Them Something Beautiful, is going to be released this spring. And by the way, in 2014, he released the world's first Augustinian soul album, Late to Love. So, you know, you can find out about that. And anyway, welcome to the show, Sam Rocha.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and guess what? We are also joined by Mr. Michael Litchens, my Tuesday co-host. I wasn't sure if Michael was going to be here or not. How you doing, Michael?
I'm doing great. I'm very excited to see we have Sam on the line here today.
Yes, we're having a cross-continental experience. So Michael is talking to us from Denver, Colorado.
Nice.
And Sam is up there in British Columbia.
My favorite part of the planet. Yes.
Yes, up there with the moose and squirrel. Or maybe that's Frostbite Falls, Minnesota. I'm not sure. But anyway, how are things going with you, Sam Rocha?
Oh, things are good. I mean, the weather right now is, I moved here from North Dakota, so the whole idea was that we weren't going to get snow in Vancouver, and it's been snowing just like crazy this year. So you know that. You guys have been getting it down there, too.
Yeah, we're in the kind of the same basic ecosystem. Yeah. You know, one of my favorite experiences was, I'm a fan of Stargate. And Stargate, which concerns all three of us, because I'm a fan, and Stargate is set in Colorado, although it's Colorado Springs, not Denver. Mm-hmm. And but it was filmed actually not very far from you, Sam, in Vancouver and environs. And so it's basically the same ecosystem. It's just kind of right up the road from my house. And there's bird. My wife is kind of a birder. So I'm familiar with bird calls. I can actually identify birds from their calls because my wife is enough of a bird nerd that I've learned that. And so it's always delightful to me when the Stargate team goes and visits some other world that always looks remarkably like just outside Vancouver in British Columbia. And you can hear the birds in the background on planets on other side of the galaxy. And they all sound like, robins and olive-sided flycatchers and all these other birds that live in our area, because that's what they are.
So you're saying that aliens have the same birds?
Yes. Aliens across the galaxy have the same birds. There are explanations for these things that I don't want to go into right now because it's too nerdy. But I thought it would be – I was interested in a couple of things just because – You have kind of an interesting confluence of experiences and job that I thought would be interesting to discuss. So you're teaching philosophy up there in Canada to actual authentic Canadians. What philosophy are you teaching exactly? Philosophy is a pretty wide field.
Yeah, no, that's so my subfield in philosophy is philosophy of education.
Okay.
That's not just my topic. It also affects me institutionally in that I teach in a department of educational studies, which is sort of like a kind of like a Noah's Ark idea where like they have two anthropologists, two sociologists, two historians, two philosophers, so on and so forth, you know, 17 okay. cultural studies. Of course, I don't know how they pulled that one off.
Are you expected to breed or is this?
Yeah. That metaphor just blew up on me there.
Okay. We're putting you in a boat.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. Okay. So we're all there, ostensibly studying education. So that's what makes it educational studies. So I actually teach philosophy of education, which basically there's a range of stuff from political theory, because politics and education kind of interface a lot, all the way to stuff like questions of like, what does research look like in like a humanistic humanities based environment as opposed to social science in education? Okay. And so I do all of that in this kind of weird interdisciplinary department in the Faculty of Education, as opposed to the more traditional philosophy department in the Faculty of Arts. Yeah.
Okay. So you're Catholic, obviously Catholic. Philosopher.
Yeah.
Living in Canada. Kind of watching now from across the board, Mexican background, but
yep.
but born in America.
Yep. We're the people who the border crossed in the 19th century. Yeah. So on both sides, no, we literally say this in Spanish, La frontera nos cruzó. It literally means the border crossed us. We didn't cross the border.
Okay. Just minding your own business and suddenly found yourself inside the United States.
Yeah, yeah. No,
we have communities of that in Colorado. It's hysterical.
Yes. So my mom's side of the family, Cortez, Colorado, that's one of those communities. On my dad's side, my grandfather, if you were to tell him to go back where he came from, and he never spoke English a day in his life, he would go north to the ranch just south of San Antonio where he was born in San Ysidro, Texas. But so Mexican and a very kind of like not a Mexican national, just a Mexican, you know. Just, yeah.
But clearly not qualified to be a federal judge in any way.
Yeah, of course not. No.
So I mean, have you had trouble crossing the border?
It's so interesting because I grew up a long part of my life on both sides of the southern border, and crossing the border was just, you know, a really normal thing. And I remember whenever the first Bush was in office, whenever there was a little kind of they got a little bit stricter. They took away some produce from us at one point and stuff. But it was a pretty routine thing. And one thing people don't realize on the southern border, all the immigration officers are all Mexicans too.
Right.
So it's this very kind of interesting. I always say, if you want to understand immigration from like the most microscopic level, you have to go down to the borderlands and go to El Paso or to the Rio Grande Valley and stuff, and realize that like. It's the spectrum from U.S. to Mexico isn't really drawn the way the border draws it, you know. But at any rate, for the first time in my life, and I'm not trying to be dramatic about this, but I'm a little bit nervous about I'm headed to New York with my son this week. And I'm kind of getting a little bit I'm making sure I have lots of paperwork and I can explain what I'm doing and that kind of stuff. Just because, you know, it's a little tense.
Because it's so weird. Yeah. They stopped some French.
I know. That's
Holocaust
what got me so nervous.
Historian.
I know.
I mean, it's just so weird, you know.
A scholar. Yeah.
Yeah.
When I saw that, I was like, sheesh, I really need to print out a copy that I'm actually giving this lecture in New York.
it could be a lecture on the greatness and goodness of our dear leader and the rightness of his cause.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if you remember, but I was writing at Vox Nova for a while.
Yes.
And in 2011, I actually endorsed Trump for president in 2011.
I remember that, Sam. By the way, I want you to know I never bothered you about it. I know my job is to troll you, but.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's featured in the book of essays coming out, which is a collection from, you know, about 200,000 words of all that stuff, edited down to about 90,000. But yeah, I endorsed him as the president we deserve.
Well, that's,
and I stand by that endorsement.
I was gonna say that's yeah. grimly true. Yeah. wow. So
Stone the Prophet.
okay. Well, you know, and that reminds me. Let's talk about your book a little bit.
Sure.
You've written a book, a collection of essays called "Tell Them Something Beautiful." Talk about that. What are you trying to achieve in that book?
Sure. Well, I mean. I started blogging in the year 2005, right after I graduated from Franciscan University and Steubenville. And you know, it was sort of it was sort of like
freaky liberal schools.
Then. I know. Just yeah, completely. You know, just like the Oberlin for Catholics. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But at any rate, you know, I before I knew it, I realized I've written a lot of stuff, not just at blogs, but also at these kind of weird digital publication plays like the First Things Online and stuff. And so I just wanted to gather them together. That was the first impulse, at least.
Okay. Well, let's talk more about that when we return. You're listening sure. to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sam Rocha. And Michael Litchens, and we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
And welcome back to Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with refugee philosopher Sam Rocha. having fled the United States for the happier clime of the University of British Columbia, where he is teaching there. He's also a pastoral philosopher in residence. Now, what does a pastoral philosopher in residence do? I'm curious.
Oh man, you're asking all the tough questions.
All hard questions.
Well, it's basically I'm mainly that I do their continuing education program. I do quite a bit of just basically talks at parishes and at schools. And the word pastoral philosophy is actually a term I think I coined in a book I wrote to basically describe kind of how I see the kind of philosophy that I do. Kind of what it is, as opposed to maybe like really traditional academic philosophy. It's basically my own pet term for what I think philosophy of education is, okay. which is ultimately kind of pastoral, and kind of in the way that there's a difference between systematic theology and pastoral theology.
Okay. What now, for those of us, I of course know, duh, the difference between systematic theology and pastoral philosophy, but Michael Litchens doesn't know. Yeah, that's it. That's the ticket.
Yeah. Well, so I
wanted to spell that out a little bit.
Yeah, the distinction, as far as I see it, is that in many cases, systematic theology, but also other kinds of theology. It's really interested in doing what you could call kind of the scholarly work of either kind of building the historical nuances of arguments and kind of cataloging those and understanding them and making distinctions, or on the other hand, actually speculating within that tradition, working on some of the old claims. So, you know, you know, the problem of evil is still getting kicked around in some places, and, sure. and that's really great and it's really important. I don't really think though that necessarily pew sitters, whenever we engage in listening to homiletics, for instance, that we first and foremost are really charging at trying to get our head around the problem of evil. In many cases, we're trying to live our lives or become right. holy or, you know, yeah. stuff like that. And so pastoral theology, I think, has given the church an ability to communicate with people who are involved in this kind of pastoral work, in particular with lay people in the case okay. of ordained people. And I see philosophy kind of as in a similar way as kind of being able to do that as well. And a lot of the work I do philosophically is not with even philosophy majors, but it's with people who are asking questions or trying to right. understand ideas in a very basic way, I suppose.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and it's interesting to note that the very first New Testament documents that we have are essentially pastoral theology. It's Paul's talking to various audiences who have already heard the story of Jesus.
Yeah.
So the Gospels haven't been written yet. So, yeah. for example, the first account that we get of both the resurrection and of the institution of the Eucharist come to us not from the Gospels, but from Paul writing to the Corinthians. And he's not giving them news. He's not telling them a story that they've never heard before.
Right.
Rather, he is talking to an audience that all have shared access to this story. They've already heard the story of Jesus.
Yeah.
And so he's reminding them of what happened in the institution of the Eucharist and in the story of the resurrection. But mostly what he's doing is he's running around to various communities, and in light of the story that they've already received, he's now putting out pastoral fires and yeah. Trying to encourage them in places where their faith is weak, or
right.
you know, slapping them around sometimes because
they're idiots,
you know. And so it's pastoral theology that came first in the documents of the church. And later on, we're getting the story of Jesus written down in the Gospels because the apostles are starting to die off.
Right.
And so the church is making sure that the story gets written down and written down right. And legends don't start getting added to it, you know.
Sure.
But you really don't get even a stab at systematic theology in the church's history until, Origen is the first guy to really give it a whack.
Yeah, no, for sure, Christology for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, to me, I actually think even before Paul, when we look at the other side of pastor and pastoral, which takes us to sheep.
Right.
And so the idea of pastoral literature, but also the idea of the pastoral imagination of Judeo-Christianity, the Christ as both lamb and as good shepherd. Mm-hmm. And whenever you think about sort of the way, kind of the poetics of how the church and tradition and Christ himself taught, that to me also suggests a particular kind of primacy of the pastoral. Right.
Yeah.
And I think that applies as well for philosophy as it does for theology. In fact, I would even want to claim that there's a perhaps lowercase s secular sense of the pastoral that in some sense serves as a kind of buttress for the sacred sense of the pastoral that comes in, you know. And this is, of course, takes us back to the old, what does Athens have to say to Jerusalem? But mm-hmm. you might guess what my answer on that would be. Yeah. A lot.
I was going to say, yes, probably quite a bit.
Yeah. Just a tad.
That's the fascinating, you know, you're right. One of the things that Hans Urs von Balthasar talks about in his models of the church, he looks at different saints, so Mary, Peter, John, and Paul,
mm-hmm.
Who were not a folk band in the 60s, and looks at each of them and says that they can function as different models of the church. And it's Mary that is for him the foundation of everything else. So the Church of Discipleship comes first. The Church of Office, which you might think he would put first because you are Peter and upon this rock I will build my church and so forth. But in his reckoning, what's, and I think that he's right, is what comes first is the disciple. And it's only later that you get a Church of Office. And the reason a Church of Office exists is because there are already disciples there that need to be shepherded. And so it's only after the disciple. And so it really begins with experience. I had a priest friend one time who said that, you know, revelation is not, it's not like a math problem where you have, you know, factors and you figure them out and you arrive at some equation. He said discipleship is a lot, and revelation is a lot more like falling in love than it is like solving a math problem.
Sure.
So you're minding your own business. You know, you don't set out to meet the person who's going to change your life.
Right.
You just thought you were going to the store to pick up some milk.
Yeah. No, I mean, in a way, that point you make actually gets back to the question about what the book's about, because I gave you kind of the very vulgar, like, I just wanted to collect some writings and stuff like that. But the title, Tell Them Something Beautiful, the basic argument that the book tries to make is that essentially whenever we make the claim that the Catholic Church is committed to the truth or possesses the fullness of truth, that oftentimes our theory of truth is equivalent to 1 + 1 = 2 or some logical syllogistic apparatus, but that ultimately the truth is not told in logic or in mathematics. The truth is told in beauty, so I claim. And so to tell them something beautiful is to do something that is in some sense more true than merely telling the truth, but it's testifying to the truth, showing the truth. And I think that's ultimately kind of one of the modern in some ways, I actually think this is a bit more dangerous, in fact, than flat out relativism, because a lot of people, I think, hold on to this notion of truth that is itself not actually the truth that we proclaim, not the truth that we actually conceive of. It's actually a modern scientific, mathematical, logical apparatus. And so this book is about giving testimony to the truth, and also the critical claim that any truth that's not told in beauty is not true.
Oh, I like that. That's very Augustinian. Good. You should do like an album about this. Some kind of music, you know?
Yeah, you know, I should maybe try to learn guitar or something.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Well, you're right. Yeah. And I think that it's especially the case today that we're living in a culture that much more deeply responds to God as the beautiful than God as the true. Although there's a funny way in which those things connect in the postmodern mind. Well, you know, I think of the Pharrell Williams song, the
happy,
happiness is the truth. There is a connection there, you know, and it's certainly a connection that's a classical one. God is the one, the true, the good, and the beautiful.
Sure. Sure. The three transcendentals.
Yeah. Rats. And it looks like we're out of time for this segment, but we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today with Sam Rocha and Michael Litchens. And we'll be back right after this. Redbox.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sam Rocha. It's Dr. Sam Rocha, right?
You can call me Doctor. It's okay.
Dr. Sam Rocha.
Yeah, you're allowed.
And,
yeah.
Okay, I will do that. And not Doctor, but Mr. Michael Litchens. And nope. we're talking about your new book. Now, when is it going to be out? Tell me something beautiful.
Yeah, so I'm told it'll be out by the end of April, if not early May.
Okay. Wonderful.
So right around the corner.
Who's publishing it?
This is with Cascade Books, an imprint of Whip and Stock, great folks down in Eugene, Oregon. Yeah.
My hometown. Very nice.
Hey. Yeah. Whoa. Yeah. Great press.
I've actually known the men who run Whip and Stock for years. They were part of the reason why I came back to Christianity. The good folks.
Yeah. Wait. They're awesome. They're so great.
Did you say Whippenstock or Whiffenstock?
Okay, so I don't actually know how to pronounce it, Mark.
Okay.
There's a P and there's an – yeah, it's
– Oh, Whippenstock.
Yeah, Whippenstock. Okay.
Is that how you do it?
As if the P and F were a PH, like a sound. Oh, it's real.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So now everyone knows I don't know how to pronounce my publisher's name.
It's all right.
No one does.
Now I'm tempted to sing the Whippenstock song. But I
know, right?
We're poor little lambs who have lost. Okay, I'll stop now. Anyway, let's continue talking about your book. What else? Tell me some more fun stuff you've got in this collection of essays.
Well, the whole thing kind of kicks off after the introduction, which I liked, and after a foreword by Max Lindenman. That Max Lindenman is the editor for it.
Okay.
Yeah, he slogged through 200,000 plus words of essays and did me the favor of telling me what was garbage, which is a really huge favor.
Okay.
And then worked over the prose, he's obviously a great writer. And so, after the foreword and the intro, you basically have the first section is a searing critique of liberalism.
Okay.
And the claim, of course, is that today, although we like to talk about conservatives and liberals, basically we just have different degrees of liberalism from one side of the spectrum to the other.
Yep.
And so, someone will have to get used to the fact that the critique of liberalism is all inclusive and it includes all of the right. And I even name people like Rush Limbaugh and other people in there,
Okay.
And so that's how it starts. And then the next section is a section where I really feature my kind of educational, both critique and construction. So this idea of deschooling is something I write about quite a bit and think about.
Okay.
And I have a series of essays in there about teaching as deschooling, deschooling religious education, and then towards the end about teaching in a more constructive way. And mainly at the end, I end with some stories about some teachers that I just thought were amazing.
Can you define what you mean by deschooling? All I can think of is Yoda.
Yeah. I mean, you could say like there's a few different ways to cut it, but essentially, putting on my academic hat, it's a little bit different than what John Holt called unschooling, and it comes from a guy named Ivan Illich, and he wrote a book called Deschooling Society in 1973, and kind of coined the term in that. But essentially, what deschooling is and what the deschooling community is a sort of alternate of the alternate of the alternate of homeschooling, across the world a bit. It's kind of like people who are neither libertarians nor kind of hippie anarchists, but still want to do homeschooling, but don't want to follow the curriculum in the kind of way what they do. For me, I've developed it into a critique of compulsory schooling, and mainly though it survives on one simple distinction, basically to say that there's a difference between schooling and education. And that we can't confuse education with schooling.
And what is that distinction?
The distinction is basically that schooling is not necessarily about education. It can be, and in some cases it is, but that education ultimately is something far, far bigger, far grander, and it's not something that can be institutionalized. Which actually the Catechism and the Catholic Church has taught for millennia now as well.
Okay. The only thing that I know, this is one of those things that I picked up because I'm a nerd who pays attention to Latin roots of words.
Sure.
is that to educate means to draw out.
Yeah, yeah.
And which is, I think most of us think of education as putting things in.
Right.
Here's a big empty head, and now we'll pour some stuff in. And yeah, so anyway, talk about some of the other.
So whenever you get past the whole deschooling thing, you get into mainly like something around the realm of, you could call it, I suppose, kind of cultural critique and commentary. Almost, I don't want to call it cultural studies mainly because I've made a lot of enemies in that field, but I suppose you could even call it that. I talk a bit about Pope Francis, for one.
Okay.
And in particular,
the most dangerous enemy our church faces today, that Pope Francis. I find myself stunned every day to run across Catholics who are convinced that the two biggest threats our church faces are the Pope and Bishop Robert Barron.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
like, seriously? That's what you're worried about?
But, I know.
Go ahead.
No, these are in some sense great times whenever our biggest enemies are
the Pope and the best bishop. Evangelist yeah. Of our time. You know.
Yeah, yeah. So. It's a fairly odd time, but you know, I actually talk about Benedict as well in the earlier sections. But I focus on Francis. You know, because back in the day when I was writing, I was actually really excited about Benedict, and I thought his writings were very politically charged in some ways.
I love Benedict yes. so much.
Yeah, and so you know right. I kind of feel like Francis gets a lot of attention, as he should in many respects, but I do feel a little bit like people forget that Benedict wasn't exactly Trump's Pope or anything, you know.
Right.
Quite the opposite. As you said, you know, back in the day, I remember because I came into Catholicism and like maybe 9 months after I was confirmed, Benedict was elected Pope. And I came from a conservative evangelical household, and Benedict's writings really challenged a lot of that, especially my views on economics, which I thank God mm-hmm. for. But a lot of people forget that he was no fan of capitalism.
Mm-hmm. Not at all. And of course, we have George Weigel in mm-hmm. with the gold and the red letter pen about mm-hmm. what parts the gold parts are from Benedict and the red are from, you know, the peace and justice crazy
Marxist
people in the Vatican.
Yeah.
So there was already a lot of controversy going on with Benedict. I remember whenever it was controversial to write about Benedict, in fact. Mm-hmm. Now all of a sudden everyone's pining for Benedict to come back and saying his only mistake was resigning and da da da, and that's just crazy to me. Yeah.
I've never understood that, but it's amazing the kinds of narratives that people can concoct in order to cope with the fact that the church is telling them things that they just don't want to hear.
Yeah, no. And so yeah. I defend a very, in this case, you could actually just call me a conservative in this respect. I defend a hermeneutic of continuity, mm-hmm. Nothing crazy. And I try to draw that out in different ways. But then beyond that, I also think try to think a bit about, for instance, the value of cultural Catholicism, whereas in many cases it's kind of put down as a kind of not quite intense enough because we need to be evangelical Catholics, and cultural Catholicism seems to kind of give things away. And I make an argument for why cultural Catholicism is actually not necessarily opposed to evangelical Catholicism. Mm-hmm. And also I look quite a bit and I think in hopefully interesting ways at the question of race, which includes questions of I have a talk I gave at Wabash College when I was teaching there called White History Month, which I gave during Black History Month.
Okay.
And the argument of that talk was essentially to historicize whiteness as a historical invention, essentially, and to ask some, you know, kind of tough existential questions about what exactly does this concept mean? What are its implications? And then later on, I go into things like, in particular, Mexican identity. I have a whole essay about a priest who was he called himself an Arab. He was a Lebanese priest, Father Sam Holmesy, a great mentor of mine, and how he desegregated the Mexican and white churches in West Texas during his time there, and kind of the story of that and how that ties into the story of Guadalupe. So I think a good bit about the question of race, and hopefully not just in one direction or another direction, but at the end of it, my claim is that, you know, and this ties in, of course, with cultural Catholicism, that, you know, any sense of the church and any sense of humanity that has to sterilize its anthropology as a way to avoid conflict is in some ways going to have some immediate benefits, but in the long term is going to ultimately sacrifice some enormously beautiful aspects of the human condition.
Excuse me. Unfortunately, you know, race has become, you know, it's back.
Yeah.
It's never really been gone. But I think for a lot of people, we're up against a break, but when we return, we'll continue to discuss this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sam Rocha and Michael Litchens, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Hey, with Sam Rocha and Michael Litchens. And before we went to the break, you mentioned something that has unfortunately, well, it's, you know, it's the everlasting struggle of, you know, the American founding, our original sin, racism. It's part of American DNA. You know, we're a country that was founded by Europeans who immediately began importing slaves. And we've got, you know, we've got a big history of genocidal actions against Native Americans, you know, and endless, you know, struggles between English speakers and Spanish speakers on our southern border. And it just goes on and on. It's just always been part of American life. And for me, I mean, this last year has been a real education. As somebody who always self-identified as a conservative and who assumed that that really meant taking seriously. When I self-identify as a conservative, it's because I want to conserve things.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I want to do that is because I'm a Catholic. It, you know, to be a Catholic means to belong to a tradition, and to belong to a tradition means to be conserving something. You're guarding. That's what Paul tells the bishops to do: guard the deposit of faith that's been entrusted to you.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're trying to conserve, or what I've always thought I was trying to conserve, was the Catholic tradition, not old sin, right?
Right.
And there is such a thing as a kind of a shadow tradition in human history. Just because something is old doesn't necessarily mean it's good, because, of course, original sin is old. And that doesn't mean it's good. And so for me, you know, as a
rotten milk is old too.
Rotten milk is old, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, for me, watching the Trump campaign play to the absolute worst in human nature, and you know, making naked appeals to you know, white supremacists, to you know, the alt-right, which is just, as far as I'm concerned, is just Nazis in bow ties. In their, you know, in their mom's basement, attempting to be slightly more sophisticated. And, you know, but these guys, they invited the literal, you know, the Austrian Freedom Party leader was invited to the inauguration, a party that was actually founded by a Nazi.
Right.
And, you know, so I watched this for the last year, and my response was, you know, if that's what it means to be a conservative in the United States, then the hell with that. This has nothing to do with the gospel. And so I checked out of all of that, you know. But it was a real shock to me to watch Christians in particular. I mean, nobody is a bigger supporter of Trump than conservative American Christians.
Right.
And they went within the space of a year. They went from saying, no, we won't support this guy, to we will defend him no matter what.
Yeah.
Everything that he says and does, we will back him 100%. And, you know, my response to this all along has been what Jesus warns about. Jesus never warned about persecution. He says, you can expect it. You know, if they did it to me, they're going to do it to you. So get used to it. He never warned about persecution. What he always warned about was seduction.
Yeah.
Don't fear those who can kill the body, he says, fear him who can destroy both body and soul in hell. Be afraid of seduction. And Catholics, you know, who have given themselves over to this, I am gobsmacked.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I was gonna say that the thing that's always struck me as awkward, and I mean, I think there's a part of the question of race is always, using a big word here, but phenomenological. In other words, we experience it through our own experience of who we are. And so, mm-hmm. you know, as a guy who's never been white before, I probably race in a different way than others do. I've also never been black before. So I don't know, you know, in the US, the conversation race tends to be this white black binary. And so oftentimes, you know, people who are just, you know, more or less brown kind of don't know what to do in that. But the other thing that's sort of awkward to me, and I always was sort of slightly almost embarrassed, was that scripture happens like that. We had maps in our Bibles whenever I was a kid, and I would watch and look at them. And scripture happens like not in Europe. And Jesus is notable. Not exactly like a European guy. And my great idol of the early church, Augustine, is African. And
right. But the pictures tell me they look like the Bee Gees.
Yeah, but I always thought that was like, you know, local devotion. Oh, that's exactly. So cute. All the Germans want Jesus to look German or whatever. And that was fine to me because, by the way, Our Lady of Guadalupe looks like a Mexican princess, right?
Yes. So
I was like, that's cool. That's fine. I don't have any objections to that. But surely everyone's also aware all the time that Jesus actually wasn't white or European, didn't speak English, wasn't American, wasn't even Catholic for that matter, right?
Yep.
And I've been becoming slowly aware of the fact that it's actually scandalous to suggest that. It's like I was once told by someone that that Americans should speak English, and I asked him if he was British. Right. And I was instantly blocked because I had the temerity to suggest that maybe English people speak English. But there's something like a failure of, I don't know what it is, Mark, but I'm realizing, and I don't mean to sound like your average professor, you know, but there's a profound stupidity at work in the fact that it's on the page and it's on the map. And there's a huge counterfactual in front of all of us in the person of Christ, even at a sociological level, at a historical level, that somehow, some way, these evangelical types are missing, and it's sort of awkward.
Yeah. Well, and to me, what's shocking has been watching Catholics absorb this mindset.
Well, yeah, that's
in the United States.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, you know, come on, you guys. I mean, 50 years ago, we were the outsiders. You know, it wasn't until the election of JFK that we
and JFK
finally
had to give a speech. Do you remember this?
Basically, yes. Saying, oh, I'm not really a Catholic. You know?
Right, exactly. He had to give a speech basically saying, look, I'm not going to have a line from Rome that comes in and tells me to nuke whoever. Or like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so this, the weirdness to me of watching, I saw this 10 years ago. We saw people giving, we heard the big spiel about demographic winter. You know, the Muslims are outbreeding us and we Christians have to start doing something about this because if they, you know, outnumber us, then terrible things are going to happen. And so, okay, great. Well, here's 20 million people coming across the border. The overwhelming number of them are Christian.
Yeah.
They're here because they want to work hard, make a better life for themselves and have a place for their kids. There's your population boom that you were worried about. And the response is, well, not those kind of Christians.
Right.
Because they're brown.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And yeah. Also, by the way, I think that there's also a situation in the U.S., which is very much a Protestant nation, and that it feels natural. It has a natural fear of Catholic culture. Yeah. And like the way it went after the Irish, the way it went after the Italians, the way it went after the Catholic Germans, the way, I mean, it's done this so many times historically. Mm-hmm. The other side of the whole thing, though, that's really crazy to me, at least, is and this is something I have to say because of what I said in the first segment, is that like we have towns called Los Angeles, San Diego, Santa Fe, El Paso, San Antonio. And they're not just in Spanish, but they're mostly all religious. Los Angeles means the angels. Right. San Diego. In other words, we have geographic markers across our nation that are both not in English and, second of all, deeply Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is, to me, like an obvious, another astounding counterfactual to the narrative that somehow there's something un-American about cultural Catholicism in a Mexican or Spanish register, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's always already been the case ever since Mexico lost the Mexican-American War.
Yeah. And one of the things that I've always appreciated about the Catholic Church in the United States is that it's just not freaked out by any of this. So you go into a Catholic church, you know, here in Washington or pretty much anywhere, you know, where there's a big Latino population. And guess what? It's bilingual.
Yeah.
And it's not a problem. It's not like some crisis that faces us that we have to do something about because it's an emergency. It's just, well, you know, a lot of people in our parish speak Spanish. So we'll do things in Spanish too, and it's.
I've always wanted to suggest to the traditionalists that maybe we should have all masses be in Spanish because it's closer to Latin.
Closer to Latin.
It's the Latin vernacular, so we'll just have Latin Spanish mass universally.
Well, I think that's a great idea, but it's one of the things that I've always appreciated about it. The church sort of gets on with things and says, "Well, here's the reality on the ground, so let's." You know, it's like gonna kill us to learn some Spanish, and there you go. You know, everything's gonna be fine. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Dr. Sam Arocha. Your book is available, coming out next month. It's called
Tell Them Something Beautiful.
Tell Them Something Beautiful. And I want to thank you as well for being on the show today, Mr. Michael Litchens. And our producer today was Danny Head. And I want to thank all of you guys out there in Radio Land for listening in. We'll be back tomorrow with Rod Bennett on Connecting the Dots. Until then, bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.